You're listening to Changing Course. This is Todd Steed, and I'm talking to Paul F. Brown, who has a new book out. It's called Rufus, James Agee in Tennessee. Well, there's been a lot written about James Agee. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much written about his time in Tennessee. Why did you decide to tackle that era?
I got interested in Agee after reading A Death in the Family, and was motivated to do that after reading some things Jack Neely had written about the local tragedy and how that's been commemorated, and of course the fact that it had been written about in James Agee's Pulitzer Prize winning novel. So after reading that, I was very moved by it and fascinated by the fact that it all happened here so local. I mean, same streets where you can walk. You know, they've of course had a lot of Agee ambles and walking tours to where, you know, people love retracing the steps that Agee made with his father from downtown back to Highland Avenue. And that kind of stuff fascinates me. Local history that you can kind of reach out and touch in some instances. Unfortunately, Agee's house is no longer here. But learning about all that, I was just fascinated to learn more about Agee's family and about the events and places he wrote about in A Death in the Family. And so I hadn't intended on writing a book. I was just curious for personal reasons to find out more about Agee. And so it turned into a hobby and went to a lot of libraries and collections and archives trying to answer some of these questions about Agee's life. Of course, there had been a couple biographies written about him already. One published in 1977, and the more recent one in the mid-80s by Lawrence Bergreen. And both of those were helpful, but there was still a lot that wasn't answered about his Tennessee years. For example, Lawrence Bergreen's biography gives us about 50 pages total about Agee's years in Tennessee. You know, considering Agee lived in Tennessee for about a third of his life, his short life. 50 pages, you know, encompassing his ancestry all the way up to the time he left Knoxville for the last time, I didn't really feel was adequate.
Agee's time in Tennessee really informed Death in the Family, mm-hmm. but can you speak to how it might have informed other parts of his creative output?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the interesting things that I learned along the way. And chapter 5 in the book, I basically take a look at Agee's writing career from the very beginnings all the way through the end of his life. And I take a look at the ways that Tennessee continued to inspire him creatively throughout his life. One thing I found really interesting that the earlier biographies were a little bit misleading on is if you read the other biographies, you get the sense that Agee didn't really start writing until he left Tennessee and enrolled at Phillips Exeter Academy. What I found out, I actually found a statement from Agee where he says, "I began writing about age 12 in Tennessee." And so that's straight from his mouth. He would have been still a student at St. Andrew's School down in Sewanee at that time. We don't necessarily have evidence of his early writings, whether they weren't preserved or maybe he kind of used them later and we only see what came out of it later. I did find his first, for all we know, his first published work, which was a book review he wrote at Knoxville High School. And that's right there at the beginning of chapter 5. And it the byline is Rufus Agee. And, of course, he didn't really publish anything else under that byline, but it at least connects his local identity, what he was known as here in Knoxville. He went by his middle name, Rufus, and he kind of discarded it after he left Tennessee. But that little example from Knoxville High School shows that, you know, he was writing as Rufus Agee, and, of course, that little piece was published, I don't know, 6 months before his first pieces at Phillips Exeter Academy, and probably about 14 years before he was reviewing books for Time Magazine, You know, his very first one was here in Knoxville. So his earliest kind of fictional pieces were just about all set in Tennessee, some in Knoxville. He has some early examples of poetry that he bases on, you know, the death of his father. It wasn't explicit, but he's talking about, you know, he's gone away. He has this poem called Ebb Tide. And although he doesn't identify the he in that poem, it seems like he's talking about his father and the loss and how it affected him, his own life. He has another one called Widow, where a mother and her two children are spending Christmas holiday, but she had just buried their father, her husband, on Christmas Eve, and she's trying to keep up appearances and, you know, giving the children a holiday, but yet she's struggling inside with the fact that she's missing her husband's embrace and things like that. So, I mean, it's fictionalized, of course, but you can see the seeds of a lot of his work in fiction with the real-life death of his father here in Knoxville in 1916. You know, it was kind of a theme that he kept returning to throughout his work. So I tried to include as many of those instances in that fifth chapter of my book, just to show that he did remain connected to Tennessee, even though he hadn't been a resident since his 15th year, but he did remain connected emotionally and creatively, and I think that's something that hadn't been pointed out before in the previous biographies.
So you started this almost, it sounds like, as a hobby. You're just doing your own research for your own edification, your own enjoyment. At what point did you say, hold it, why can't this be a book? That there had to be a moment when that occurred to you.
Yeah, there was, and I have to credit my wife Jessica with that. And I don't know if she did it just to give my hobby direction and purpose, but she's a writer herself. She's a freelance writer, and she saw the depth that I was going into this topic, and she suggested, hey, maybe you could make a book out of this. And the thought hadn't occurred to me because I'd never tried to write a book before. I'd done, of course, some academic papers and stuff in college, but nothing that even remotely approaches this level of research. But again, I didn't really see it as an assignment. Certainly no one was asking me for it. It was just something that was hugely interesting. And so once my wife suggested the book, I said, all right, I'll go through and in some cases had to go back and look at sources that I'd found in a different way because I hadn't, noted them as sources in a way that a historian would or a serious researcher. So I had some backtracking to do, but once I got started on that track, it at least gave me a kind of a goal in mind.
Did it just really fuel you to make it a real thing?
Oh, it did. Yeah, and I could see that there was a need for it. Just the fact that nothing had been written like this on AG, to where it was specifically looking at his early life and how it affected his career, and then being so close here to the University of Tennessee and the University of Tennessee Press, it seemed like a natural fit. Of course, it wasn't a sure thing right off the bat. I had to do some revisions and things like that naturally, but I had a lot of encouragement once people found out what I was up to here, and had a lot of helpful pairs of eyes looking through this and showing me places where I could strengthen it, and pointing out some things that maybe I'd overlooked or missed.
Having never written a book and then say, okay, I'm going to be an author, I'm going to write a book, what was the hardest part?
I think I'm the kind of person who gets bogged down in details, and some people reading this book now may agree with that. I think the hardest part for me was getting over some humps to where I felt really in over my head, particularly in the fifth chapter I've already mentioned, which deals with his writings. You know, I'm not an English major. My wife was here at UT, but I wasn't used to doing literary analysis. And, you know, my analysis is not necessarily all that complex. what I was mainly looking for was pieces of his writing where there might be an autobiographical connection. I know that's a tricky area because a writer of fiction can, you know, all writers of fiction to some degree use their background to inform characters, situations, places, and that's their prerogative. There's no rules when it comes to that, and so readers will hopefully forgive some leaps that I've made. I tried not to push things too hard and say this was a definite inspiration for this piece. I tried to suggest and give evidence and use them as clues, hopefully, to his background. But I know that previous biographers have also erred in that department and sometimes lifted dialogue straight out of the fiction and plunked it in as though it were an actual conversation between his AG's relatives. So hopefully I avoided some of those type of missteps there. But that was a hard chapter to get through just in organizing it because some of the writings weren't necessarily dated. In some of the collections, you know, some of the here at the Special Collections Library at UT, they have a wealth of AG materials. Some of it's datable, some of it's not. And so sometimes I had to group stories or pieces of his writing by theme rather than in a chronology. But I tried my best to stick to a chronology just because a biography reads the best that way and also linking it to his visits back to Tennessee. But yeah, I would say that's probably the hardest part is just getting over the fear of stepping into something that I was really didn't feel qualified at all to do, but yet felt like there was still this need, and if I wasn't doing it, who would? And I just felt it was an important enough project that I needed to push through. And I will say that, you know, my wife and I have a 2-year-old son. He was born just as this was kind of finishing, or at least my wife and I were expecting. And so that definitely gave me a solid deadline to shoot for because I knew that my time being able to just run out to a library or go somewhere for research, those days were going to be a lot more limited now that once the child arrived. So
I'm sure that turned out to be exactly the case.
That's exactly the case, yeah.
Do you think that James Agee got his due while he was still alive? And why do you think books like this and people still talking about him endure? Why do you think we still care?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I know Michael Afaro, a retired English professor who's done a lot of research and is still the general editor of this 12-volume set of AG's works that UT Press is in the middle of right now. He's talked a lot about what it is about AG that endures and, in fact, is still resonating with modern audiences. As far as whether AG got his due during his lifetime, I would say most people would say no, myself included, only because so much of his work that we now know was not even in print at the time he died in May 1955. You know, he was, if you look at his obituaries, He was known as a film critic. People couldn't really get their hands on his reviews because he hadn't really reviewed films all that much since the late 40s. He was not really well known for his book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, because it came out back in 1941 and only sold about 600 copies. Wasn't reissued until 1960. Of course, he wasn't known at all for Death in the Family because that wouldn't be published until 1957. He was probably known for his, like I said, his film reviews. People perhaps remembered him as the Oscar-nominated screenwriter of The African Queen. His name, of course, had been attached to the Night of the Hunter, even though he died before it was released. I think A Death in the Family helped rejuvenate his name and helped kind of bring him out of obscurity. Of course, Death in the Family won the Pulitzer Prize in 1958, and 2 years later is when you started to see a lot of his work being brought out from his film reviews, AG on Film, which is a popular compilation. Let Us Now Praise Famous Men came out. Not too long after, his a collection of his short prose and his poetry, both edited by Robert Fitzgerald, those came out. So I would say it wasn't until A Death in the Family that he really achieved the kind of, at least the beginnings of popularity that he still enjoys today.
Let me ask you this. So if I were to walk up right now, and mm-hmm. it's not raining today, which is great, up Highland Avenue, where would I go to see where the house was?
Well,
and what's there now?
Yeah. If you start on Cumberland, well, for one thing, you know, here at the WUOT studios, we're very close to Circle Park. And one of the things that I bring out in the book in chapter 2, I believe, is that when A.G. was very young, he was still a toddler. Before they even bought that house up on Highland, they rented a little home on the corner of 7th Avenue in Yale, which today, of course, UT fans will know, is the corner of Philip Fulmer Way and Peyton Manning Pass. There was a little, just one-story house there in the corner, and the whole landscape has changed. I mean, most of the buildings that they would have recognized in homes are long gone. But they were just down the block from Circle Park, and I discovered some manuscripts where A.G. left some very brief comments about visiting a place called Park Circle. Of course, it was and still is known as Circle Park, but he talked about playing on the high rocks. And actually, just before I came out here, I walked over there just on the lawn. I wasn't even sure if you're supposed to walk on the grass over there, but there's a couple large chunks of limestone, I'm guessing, out there. And those could have been moved there or relocated there at some point, but it made me wonder if those could have been some of the high rocks that A.G. played on as a toddler. But yeah, his mother and father could have easily walked him up the street there and had him run around Circle Park. But yeah, if you start down here, let's say at the studio, go down to Philip Fulmer Way, head north, cross Cumberland carefully at the light, and walk up the hill, up the ridge there. When you get to Laurel, you'll pass James A.G. Park. There, I think it was the Luttrell Mansion during A.G.'s time. For many years, it was used as a parking lot by UT. Now it's a beautiful park. And you pass that, you walk another block north, and you get to Highland Avenue. You cross the street of Highland, and there's an old, what looks like could be a Victorian era house on the corner at 1501 Highland, I guess would be the address. So it's on that north side of Highland. You walk west, one lot, basically, and you get to the there's a big, hate to say ugly, but it's an ugly brick apartment building. Mainly ugly because it just doesn't fit with the character of all those Victorian houses, a lot of which are still lovingly taken care of, especially in more recent years. But yeah, right there where that apartment building is, the second lot from the corner is where A.G.'s house would have been. The address no longer exists, but in his time it was 1505 Highland Avenue. And there's a picture of it actually on the University of Tennessee Library website in some of their digital photos. But there's a few photos of it in the book that readers may not have seen before.
Nice. Well, I've been to that very spot, and I believe I watched Nightmare on Elm Street in that very ugly brick building.
Interesting.
When I was 18. Yeah, that was before I started getting into serious film and literature.
Yeah.
So it was a very scary movie.
Yeah.
Paul F. Brown has been our guest on Changing Course. His new book is called Rufus, James Agee in Tennessee. It is produced by the University of Tennessee Press, and it is a lovely book. I'm sorry you're not sitting here with us now to see it, but it's chock full of photos and drawings and just it just looks really wonderful and detailed, and I can't wait to dig into this on these rainy days here in 2019. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Todd. Yeah. I appreciate it.